Much has been written about Apple co-founder Steve Jobs and his time at the helm of the company, but less so about what happened after his death in 2011. Under Jobs, who'd quit and then returned to Apple, the company experienced a revitalization that led to the iMac, iPod, and of course the iPhone. When Jobs died from pancreatic cancer, many wondered whether the company could maintain its stellar trajectory. And that's the subject of a new book by the New York Times tech reporter Trip Mickle called After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul. In it, he focuses on the relationship between Tim Cook, Apple's COO turned CEO, and the company's chief design officer, Johnny Ive. And Trip is with us from San Francisco. Great to talk. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think this book actually came as a result of a suggestion you had about Johnny Ive, who was Apple's chief design officer until 2019. What was it that set you on this path?
Yeah, I was a newcomer to San Francisco, having moved from my previous role covering alcohol and tobacco to reporting on Apple, and met with a local journalist named John Markoff, who I was asking, you know, what should I focus on? And one of John's tips was you should ask about this guy, Johnny Ive, and a place called The Battery, which is a private club here in San Francisco. He didn't provide much more guidance than that. But over the course of several years, by asking about that, I came to learn that Johnny Ive had become disenchanted with the company that he helped build, which just was mystifying to me. And I wanted to figure out, like, how does that happen? How does somebody who loves something so much kind of fall out of love with the very thing that he helped create and make so successful?
It's also a case of looking at those who are one out and one back, to use the racing parlance, because so often these tech companies, we are fixated on the founder or on the CEO and maybe one other. But of course, there are pivotal roles directly linked to the company's fortunes that are less well known.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, in the case of Johnny Ive, I mean, he was somewhat well known, but he fell victim to this thing that happened at Apple after Steve Jobs returned, which was initially Jobs needed to burnish the image of the people who were working for the company. And so he pushed and promoted, people in the press like Johnny Ive after the launch of the iMac, the candy-colored computer that sold so well and changed Apple's fortunes. But then after it found its footing, he began to secret those people away so that nobody would poach them. And as a result, it became very much understood that most of what Apple made, it seemed to flow all from one man. That was Steve Jobs, the man on stage.
Was there an element of truth to that? Was there's no denying how formidable he was, not just as a front person, but also as an almost obsessive design perfectionist, Jobs.
Yes. But he also, I like to think of Apple as, and Jobs' success as a consequence of partnerships. And if you look back at its original formation, it was formed because of his partnership with Steve Wozniak, who was just an insanely talented engineer. And their collaboration led to them popularizing the personal computer. And when Jobs returned, this kind of like second era that he was at Apple, you know, Jobs 2.0, his partner was Johnny Ive. That's who he collaborated with most often. And that's why when he met with his biographer, Walter Isaacson, he said, you know, Johnny Ive was the second most powerful person at the company after Jobs himself. Johnny Ive was his creative soulmate. And the two of them would spend most of their time talking up and dreaming up many of the ideas that Apple would pursue and develop from a product standpoint.
You talked to an extraordinary number of people for this book, achieved largely on the basis of anonymity. And can you just explain a little bit more about the culture of omerta at Apple and the challenge as a journalist of trying to get people to speak?
Yeah, it's a real fortress of secrecy, and that was something that Jobs used to for two reasons. You know, he instituted secrecy one, to protect and provide Apple with a competitive advantage so that its rivals couldn't deduce what products it might be working on and try to front run it in the marketplace. And the other was to preserve the mystery of what it might announce. And that allowed it to have these kind of, you know, these keynotes that people would tune into by the millions, and Apple would get all kinds of press there and a ton of free advertising, in essence, for any product that it released. I think it's hard to fully appreciate just how kind of indoctrinated the culture of secrecy was. But this is very much like Fight Club. You know, the first rule of Apple is you don't talk about Apple. And people who work in different divisions don't talk to each other about what they're working on in many cases. So much so that I remember at one point talking to a couple who had retired, and they said it wasn't until many years after they had stopped working at the company that they truly opened up to each other about the different projects that they'd worked on during their years of combined service for the same place, which is just kind of, you know, one of the quirks of this company in Silicon Valley.
Was that sustained beyond Jobs? Was it sustained in the era of Tim Cook quite to the same degree? It's almost cultish, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah, no, it is very cultish. Yeah, I think that's the right word.
Was there a transition from one to t'other in terms of that culture, or was it already embedded?
It's been preserved, although there's been, it's been preserved to a large degree. In fact, I mean, it was kind of funny, even 2 weeks ago, or was it last week? It's only last week. The markets have been crazy, right? But Apple was facing a report by Bloomberg that its supplier, it had told its suppliers to reduce the number of iPhones it was going to make. And Jim Cramer, who's on CNBC every morning here in the U.S. and is a relatively well-known talking head on the business channel here, said that, you know, these suppliers know they're not supposed to talk to the press. I mean, it's so ingrained in and around Apple that even people who report on Apple seem to regurgitate the company's messaging around that, which I found kind of interesting.
Well, let's get to the starting point, I guess. And we mentioned Jobs had two stints at Apple, and then we get to 2011, and much has been written. Walter Isaacson's tome is probably foremost among them, but much has been written about him. The question is, does a company survive such a dominant, in every respect, figure? And this was Tim Cook's challenge. In fact, is it remarkable in a sense that he has sustained his role at the company this long?
Yeah. I mean, that was not something that most people would have thought would have happened after Tim Cook was tapped as Steve Jobs' successor. Jobs had several options within the company in terms of its leadership of who to tap. Johnny Ive was just almost immediately ruled out because his strength was not managing large groups of people. Tim Cook, on the other hand, had a tremendous amount of experience with that, and also was responsible for creating this super efficient supply chain that was credited with being more than half the value of what the company was worth around 2011 when Jobs died. And so he became the logical choice. What he had to do was figure out how to restructure this company that was designed to orbit around Jobs like the sun and make, you know, and defer to him on all decision making. And it took several years, but ultimately what Cook was able to introduce was a system where decisions were made by consensus more so than by decree, which was much of how Jobs operated.
What are your observations of Cook as an individual, first of all, and then we'll talk more about the pairing, because it's a theme of the book, of the pairings that have been part of the history of Apple. But just remind people, I guess, of a little of what we know about him as a character. He's notoriously private. What else represents some of his side of this dynamic in this pairing?
I think a few things that jumped out at me in working on this that maybe I failed to fully appreciate about Tim was just his his anticipation and ability to kind of see ahead of where maybe the rest of the marketplace might be and position Apple to survive various obstacles that might come up. I mean, I think foremost among those, you could point to the 6 years he spent working to negotiate a deal with China Mobile in China, which allowed the iPhone to be sold by this giant telecom company with 700 million subscribers. And on the heels of that, Apple had an 85% increase in revenue in China to $58 billion. I mean, it was really massive in terms of the way that transformed their business. Another thing that I think is pretty interesting is that he has a sense of where he is. And by that, you know, I mean, when it came time for him to eventually tell the world that he was a gay executive, he timed that at a time when Apple had turned a corner and the questions about it was basically that he chose to do so on the heels of that China deal at a time when Apple's business was, as he knew it would, taking off. And he did so because he recognized that if he failed as CEO of Apple, that would be one thing. But if he failed as the first publicly gay CEO of such a high profile company, he could set back opportunities for other LGBTQ individuals for years. And so I think he just has a sense of, you know, what he says and the meaning of it and how it matters to others in a way that few people do. I mean, I think that's a credit to his ability to see the bigger picture in all times.
A workaholic, evidently, as well. And again, that tradition of an almost obsessive focus on perfection and attention to detail seems to have been sustained under him. Let's come to to Johnny Ive, then, who, as we said, was the chief design officer. A little about him, and then we'll talk about the kind of the frustrations that came to bear on him ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Johnny is a uniquely talented individual who, you know, arguably is a prodigy. I mean, he was born and raised outside of London. His father taught industrial design, and he remembers, you know, some of his earliest memories are of watching his father's students work on projects at like the age of four. His talent was so much that in high school, when he designed a projector for his teacher went and interrogated his father because it was so sophisticated that he thought his father had done all the work, when in fact it was Johnny Ive himself. And that just set him on a path to wind up at Apple and have tremendous amount of influence over some of the minor details that distinguish Apple products, like choosing white headphones for the iPod. Like, that was not a signature feature, but it was it became a cultural phenomenon when it became the focus of their marketing campaign around that product. And in the wake of Steve Jobs' death, Johnny Ive becomes incredibly important to Apple because he, you know, kind of shakes free of some of the grief he has and decides to spearhead the development of a smartwatch that would ultimately become the Apple Watch. And that becomes key to, you know, proving to the world in this decade that Apple can still create something new. And, you know, as we look back now, it's the only new product category that they've created in the decade since Jobs' death.
So let's look at what happens between 2015, when the Apple Watch is rolled out, and the 2019 product launch that you mentioned in the prologue to the book. What's going on here, and is it about the design of a new product, one that was following an impossibly hard act to follow, or was it something else?
It really was, you know, something else. It was the culture of Apple changing around Johnny Ive that became a point of frustration, and you really see that in three. I'll mention two specific places. One, it's important to understand that because Jobs had so empowered Johnny Ive and the design team that Ive was able to turn the design studio into a sanctuary that had its own rules. And among those rules was you don't talk about cost. Well, during the development of the, you know, and if you did talk about cost in the design studio, you would have your access to that studio, your badge access, just quietly revoked. You would just show up one day, try to badge in, and you couldn't get in. During the development of the watch process, that rule began to be violated. People from operations began to talk about ways that they could develop components of the watch at a lower price. So that's just one area that you see a slip. Second thing that occurred was because decisions were being made by consensus, Johnny Ive found himself having to advocate for what he wanted. This is a designer who was accustomed to talking to Jobs directly and mostly getting his way. And if he didn't, living with Jobs making another decision. Instead, he needed to kind of engage in, you know, political infighting inside the company to push his idea forward. And he didn't enjoy that. That was not something that, for someone with an artist temperament, that he really had the appetite for. And then the third thing was he began to notice that the company was changing in ways that he didn't fully appreciate. It was losing some of what he considered to be its kind of right brain sensibilities. In particular, Tim Cook replaced a more right-brained leader on the board of directors with a left-brained leader, and Johnny dismissed that change as he's just another one of those accountants. And that those things were all kind of snowballing at a time that led, you know, Johnny Ive to kind of feel like that talking head song where he just didn't recognize the place that he was waking up anymore, and went to Tim Cook and asked to step back from the company, and eventually did so in 2019.
What was the environment of the Apple designers? You refer to them, they lived like rock stars. Can you explain a bit more about, for start, how many are there? Does anyone know? And then second, a little bit about their work hard, play hard environment.
There were about 20 designers who were part of the core design team that Johnny worked with. I mean, you talk to people at Apple and you get a variety of descriptions of them. I mean, some call them, like, you know, Apple's Jedis, right? Others call them, you know, to your point, the rock stars of the company. I mean, they were the cool kids on campus. You know, the design studio where they worked was known as the Holy of Holies. It had a different energy than most of the rest of the campus did. Most of the rest of the campus is very frenetic, and there's a lot of like intensity and in the work that people are doing. Inside the design studio, they've kind of cultivated this this kind of refuge of calm, and it's really a sanctuary. And they have you know, they have one of the guys is a DJ, and he makes sure that the music that's played is kind of electronic music with like a relatively mellow but upbeat vibe that keeps people focused on the work they're doing. Another guy is a coffee aficionado, and so they're all experts at making espressos and cappuccinos. And so the aroma of the place is like, the aroma of kind of a well-maintained coffee bar. Other of the guys are like avid surfers, and they design their own surfboards. I mean, it's a really unique place in Apple's campus because their interest and their focus goes far beyond the confines of their work there.
20 doesn't sound like a lot. Are these at the top of the tree, these designers?
Yeah. I mean, if you think of Apple as, I don't know, if you think of it as they were the tip of the spear in terms of product development. Yeah.
You mentioned 2019 and the blow-up really that happens, or the blowout perhaps, for Johnny Ive. What happened at the 2019 product launch with the interaction between Tim Cook and Johnny Ive?
Oh, that works as a prologue of the book, in part because, you know, I was just there watching it, and it was a really strange moment where Johnny Ive was spending a tremendous amount of time after they had released the Mac Pro walking around kind of by him by himself with one other colleague looking at their work. And then he seemed to be waiting for someone, and he just waiting and waiting, and it just seemed longer and longer. And finally the doors kind of open, and here comes Tim Cook with, I don't know, like a fleet of paparazzi photographers around him, and Nora O'Donnell, who is, she's a news anchor here in the U.S. doing a special on him. And the room kind of clears out, and Johnny steps in from the side to greet Tim Cook, who's really become the star of the show. And it wasn't so long ago that it was Johnny Ive who got a standing ovation when the Apple Watch was released. But here, something on the order of 5 years later, the star had, the story had shifted, and it was Tim Cook who was kind of basking in its glow.
When you talk about the company losing its soul, to what are you referring?
It's got two meanings, and the subtitle should be read in its totality. I mean, the first thing that I want to hit on is the fact that it's become a multi-trillion-dollar company, and that's a true credit to Tim Cook and his leadership of it. The losing its soul is a literal reference to Johnny Ive, who was considered by Steve Jobs to be a creative soulmate. But then beyond that, on a metaphorical level, there's also been a transformation at Apple. This was a company where creativity led to commerce, but increasingly commerce, drives creativity. And so there's just been a flip in terms of I guess what is the motivating factor for what it does.
The beautiful gadget, wasn't that always Jobs' argument? And
right.
Especially for the iPhone. Johnny Ives, I think, built an $18,000 smartwatch, Apple Watch. And again, was it a case that there was this tension between what it looks like and what it actually does?
Yeah. No, form over, form over function became a facet of what was going on. In talking with several people who worked there, I mean, they kind of compared, what happened to be kind of like the natural consequence of what occurs when a company just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the metaphor that they point to is it's kind of like, a gymnast that shows up at the Olympics, as a teenager, and just is able to do incredible things because of, age and then naivety, right? There were no expectations, and then return several years later as, say, somebody like Simone Biles did, and the weight of the world's on your shoulders. Every move is dissected to see if you made a misstep. And then not only that, but you don't, you're performing at an age where your grasp for what you're able to do physically is not the same as what it once was.
The Apple Watch and the AirPods have been, good contributors to the Apple's bottom line. Sales of wearables have been pretty tidy. And Apple itself, I think is it the largest company by market capitalization, if not by revenue, in the States? What of its future, though? A big question, a difficult question, but does it still seem to have that ability to pursue innovations and designs that are going to become mass products that sustain what it has built itself to becoming? Are there positive signs of that?
It most certainly still has that skill set. I think the challenge that it's going to have, and that I think that I'll be watching closely for, and I think many close observers of it will be looking for, is like, who is going to drive that next wave of innovation, that next product development. Historically, if you go back and look at what Apple has been able to do over the past two decades since Jobs' return, 25 years, it was Jobs himself who led and spearheaded the development of products during that kind of Camelot and Cupertino period between 1997 and 2011. And the next product that Apple developed, the Apple Watch, was spearheaded by Johnny Ive. It remains to be seen who will take that mantle forward and drive the next product to come out of the company.
Trip, thank you. Trip Mickle, After Steve, How Apple Became a $1 trillion Company and Lost Its Soul, is his book. He is a New York Times tech reporter.